This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Inside Story on BFM 89.9.
Good evening. This is Inside Story with Lee Chui Lin and Shamila Ganesan. As calls increase for Parliament to reopen, the government has agreed in principle to hold hybrid parliamentary sessions. So tonight, we're looking at what that means.
So first, we'll discuss what a hybrid parliament is and how it might work. Then we'll look at examples of this in other countries. Finally, we'll look at the wider impact of this on political stability.
So what do you make of this suggestion and this incoming reality of hybrid parliament sessions? You can call us 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. This is Inside Story. It is 6:07. Let's dive right in. So, last week, the de facto law minister, Datuk Sri Taqiyuddin Hassan, said that the government has agreed in principle to holding hybrid Dewan Rakyat and Dewan Negara sessions. As we said earlier, this comes after Parliament has not been open for a very long time now. The government has been coming increasingly under pressure for some form of Parliament to take place. And so, despite the fact that we're still not going fully virtual, it seems, because the hybrid parliament is going to be one in which MPs can partake both physically and virtually. And this was a decision arrived at after a meeting with Dewan Rakyat Speaker Dato' Azhar Azizan Harun, Dewan Negara President Tan Sri Rais Yatim, and their deputies.
So at that meeting, they discussed various aspects of how this could be executed. And that included, figuring out the infrastructure, the technical aspects, the legal aspects of what can be done, standing orders, as well as financial matters. And that agreed in principle essentially relates to the fact that further study will be done immediately on this question of having a hybrid parliament. And it will be brought to the cabinet for consideration and approval as soon as possible. This study will be done by a special committee, and the members of that committee include the Dewan Negara President, the Dewan Rakyat Speaker, a minister in the Prime Minister's department, Dewan Negara Deputy President, both deputy speakers of the Dewan Rakyat, and Parliament's Chief Administrator. Now, significantly, those who won't be included in that committee, the opposition, which has, of course, drawn a lot of criticism.
Yes, in fact, quite intense criticism, as you would expect, right? Because if we're talking about the preliminary work that needs to be done in order to have a hybrid parliament, you would need to consult, you would think, all stakeholders. I think that there is also this question of timing. So why it is that it has taken this amount of time for a hybrid parliament to be considered, when, as we've seen in other countries, they pretty much leapt into it right away. They understood the importance of having parliament continue to sit, having parliament continue to discuss, importantly, this issue of the pandemic, and they adjusted. So whether or not it was going fully virtual, whether it was, I mean, even the British Parliament figuring out a way to go into a hybrid form. I think I'm glad, I really am, that this is happening. I'm looking forward to a reconvening of a parliament of some kind. I think I just wish that it had been done sooner.
Wish it had been done sooner is, I think, practically everyone, right? Because even now with this hybrid parliament idea, once again, it's a, yes, it's going to happen, but we're going to look into it. And I think this has primarily been what creates so much frustration, because the idea of having a virtual parliament was something that's been going back and forth on, and so much discussion has been happening. And now, okay, we'll do this, but let's wait and see what we are going to do. I mean, we've had time. We've had time to work these things out.
I have to be honest. I'm a little bit afraid of getting my hopes up because...
Same.
At the moment, it's a little bit, it's a promise to make a promise. And I just think that, considering the amount of time that has elapsed, considering the fact that we are in a state of emergency and there are a lot of things that need to get done, in order for the people to make it through, I just wish that there had been a greater recognition of the importance of figuring out how to do parliament. Again, Having said that, very glad that there is some work being done in this area. So as we said earlier, we're first going to look at what form a hybrid parliament might take, how it differs from a virtual parliament, whether or not it will be able to do all the things that they would be able to do if everyone was in the day one. After that, we're going to look at how the UK did it. And finally, the thing I think that is on everybody's minds, the political ramifications also of reconvening parliament. So we're going to start off by looking at this question of a hybrid parliament. If you have thoughts on this, are you pleased to hear that we're going to have parliament of a kind? Are you optimistic it will happen? Do you have questions about what form it might take? Call us 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. Joining us after this, we will have James Chai, Head of Commercial and Research at Invoke Solutions. Keep it here on Inside Story, BFM 89.9.
Beyond Frivolous Matters, BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
It is 6:13 and you're listening to Inside Story with Lynn and Sharmila. We're looking today at Parliament, in principle, reconvening, at least in a hybrid form, which is going to be a mix of people being able to attend virtually and physically. And other countries have done this. So we have, in principle, agreed to it. And the government has said that they're going to look into it to study it further. We want to know, what are your thoughts on this? Do you have questions? You can send them our way. Call us 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. Joining us now, James Chai, Head of Commercial and Research at Invoke Solutions. James, thanks for speaking with us.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
So could you explain to us what a hybrid parliament is, how it works?
Now, a hybrid parliament is a combination of a virtual parliament, so totally online, nobody appearing in person, and as well as a fully open parliament whereby everyone actually appears in the August House. So a hybrid model is really trying to solve the difficulties of having either a totally virtual parliament, which a lot of people attribute to technical difficulties, or a totally open parliament whereby everyone attends in person. So there's of course, a lot of concerns of a heightened risk or a creation of a cluster. So a hybrid parliament, in essence, is really trying to find a middle ground that resolves both of that.
Now, are there certain things that a parliament simply cannot do completely online?
There are definitely a few things that a hybrid parliament can do better than a virtual parliament. I think the most prevalent one is actually an infrastructural issue, which is a lot of the virtual parliament or claims against a virtual parliament is really trying to find ways to relieve this technical overload. So you would hear a lot of ministers always talking about how when a parliament actually sits, it's not really just the MPs. You also involve a lot of civil servants, a lot of staff, and that would increase the amount of people involved actually to the thousands. So a hybrid parliament really tries to relieve that, which is a technical overload issue. But there's also certain issues here that having some groups of people in person that a virtual parliament cannot do. And I think more and more research over the past year have been telling us that a totally virtual environment doesn't capture a full body language, or people are more distracted. So this is a way of securing something that is more formal, that will compel potentially people who are involved to be more prepared and to treat it as real as we potentially could. And I think that's one of the sort of like a software area that increasingly more people think there is value in having some in-person meeting than none at all.
Why do you think this idea of reconvening Parliament in some form is finally being considered seriously?
Now, I think there is probably an intersection between a few elements that made this discussion so serious after 4 to 5 months. So one of it is definitely public pressure. So we should still be actually quite happy that public pressure actually works. Secondly, a rising number of cases. And thirdly, a rise in political will. Now, rising public pressure comes from this very a changed view from how voters see the importance of check and balances in parliament. Now, Malaysian voters generally are a very pragmatic group of people. They did not join the chorus of opposition MPs asking for parliament to convene around the start of the year. Only people who believe in essence of like parliamentary democracy actually thinks that that's important. Because for Malaysians generally, as long as the government can perform their tasks well, they don't actually need to see the fanfare of parliament, because a lot of people attribute it to a farce or a circus. So nothing really serious is done through parliament. But I think there is a change of heart when they start to realise that a parliament that is closed necessarily also entails that the government is inaccessible. You cannot actually ask them questions. You do not know what they're doing. And you start to see the value in having other ideas also making it to the fore. And maybe that would help the state of our country. So having someone to ask was very important. But at the same time, I think more and more within the government itself, there is a small political revolt or a creation of political will whereby more and more UMNO members who are involved in government start to realise that as this government gets increasingly unpopular, they need to distance themselves from it. And therefore, even they are interested to hold the existing cabinet ministers to account. One Ismail Sabri don't know what Azmin Ali is doing, right? Sometimes it may be a good thing for them that accountability is present for their enemies, right? So this confluence of events have really given credence to why this idea is finally being considered seriously.
So the government has said that they will be taking time to study the feasibility of this hybrid parliament. What areas would they most likely be looking into?
Yeah. So there are a few areas that they have mentioned. So there will be the housekeeping areas where they need to consider the legal implications, the change of standing orders, some infrastructure issues to know how many TVs and whether the connection is good, those kind of stuff, as well as some financial considerations to know that whether there will be additional costs imposed to make things safe, because you probably have to create more processes and procedures. But this will actually not be the bulk of the discussion, because the housekeeping issue is actually quite easy to be resolved. And as both of you mentioned just now, that a lot of countries jumped onto an opportunity for either a virtual or a hybrid parliament quite quickly, which means that existing infrastructures like the ones in our country are actually quite foolproof and quite sophisticated in it being able to accommodate for this. But I think the bulk of the discussion would probably be on more sensitive issues. So if you look into what the chairperson of this hybrid parliament committee is saying, Rais Yatim, what he said was that he will also look into MPs' behaviours as well as emergency, as well as some consideration on the stability as a whole. So all of this would imply that there will probably be some consideration of politics as well that's involved, and that also explains why the committee didn't include any of the opposition MPs.
So on that then, what role specifically is the committee going to play?
Now, the committee is actually supposed to do several studies. So this may actually still take some time, and that explains why you shouldn't really get your hopes up. Because they say that after one study, they are looking for another study to prepare a paper, and that paper will be presented to cabinet, and only then cabinet has the discretion of deciding, right? So they're actually supposed to prepare almost a foolproof environment in making sure that happens. Now, of course, in reality, what if we also consider the fact that emergency is coming to an end in August, they technically only have around like 2 months to decide it happening, but there's nothing stopping it for taking more time in deciding whether that could happen or not. So that would be the primary role, to know the feasibility of this.
Now, the other aspect of parliamentary sittings is that they've always been open for public viewing. Would the fact that these sessions happen online affect transparency in any way?
In terms of, so transparency, in my view, has two areas of consideration. One of it is the ability for you to just walk into Parliament and see it for yourself, to see the people in power answer questions. The good thing is that the number of seats in Parliament for the public is actually very few, which means that most of how we hold our MPs to account in the past has always been through TV and online. And therefore, in terms of the transparency, in the sense of being able to see it and witness it for yourself, nothing is really lost there. But in terms of transparency as a means of getting the questions answered immediately in person, that one may be severed a little bit. So what you want to be able to do is that when a person puts forth a tough question to an existing government, you want to see them being able to answer it on the spot. Only then you can assess how honest and how truthful they are and whether they are competent at their job or not. So that's at the heart of what transparency is. So some of it may be hindered, let's say in a virtual environment where there are some disruption, or let's say their drop-offs and so on. So that may come in the way a little bit, but at the heart of it, I think the bulk of transparency would still be secured, even if there are virtual elements in the parliamentary sitting.
Now, the message from the government on Parliament reopening has been mixed. We've seen different statements coming out about, for example, the Home Minister saying conducting a virtual Parliament would create problems, and then the Law Minister saying, well, no, we're studying the hybrid model now. What do you make of these contrasting messages?
Yeah, so I think what this indicates, above everything else, is that there is warring factions within government. So the group that is still very much against a sitting of Parliament in any form is really Hamzah Zainuddin, so the Home Minister. So he has claimed that either an in-person Parliament, which is too risky, it is not feasible. One that is totally virtual is not feasible as well. And he was very eager to say that nobody should really talk about a parliamentary sitting until we've achieved herd immunity of 70% of the population being vaccinated, and nobody really should, and only then we'll start thinking about it. But he did also mention one thing, which I thought was a bind for him, was that if it is possible for us to hold something in between, or if you have figured out this whole technical difficulty in holding a huge group of people online, then why not? That's what he said. So what that necessarily implies is that once the argument for hybrid Parliament has been put forth, which is put forth by the Law Minister Takyuddin at the moment, it is very hard for you to refute it thereafter. So that puts the people in quite a good place, because that necessarily means that there's still a slither of democracy in action here. Once there is enough popularity that most of the logical arguments are made to hold a hybrid model of parliamentary sitting, then it is most likely that it would happen, because any claim of not holding it now would appear very absurd. And I think more and more members within the government wants to distance themselves from people who are unpopular because they make illogical claims.
James, thank you so much for speaking with us this evening.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was James Chai, Head of Commercial and Research at Invoke Solutions, speaking to us about hybrid Parliament, right? Specifically, what form it can take, and also the mixed messaging that we've been seeing from the government on this. If you'd like to share your thoughts, send them our way. And now we have some music to take us to the news. It's the Beatles with Come Together, BFM 89.9.
Build Fairer Malaysia, BFM 89.9.
It's 6:37 and you're listening to Inside Story with Lynn and Sharmila. We're focused today on the promise of a promise to look into creating a hybrid Parliament. I laugh to keep from crying, but no, I mean, in all seriousness, the government has said that they're looking into, seriously studying the possibility of coming up with a hybrid Parliament. So in other words, the MPs will be able to attend both virtually as well as in person. It'll be a bit of a mix. And a big question here, I think, is the political ramifications of it all, because this has been something that, I mean, has been a main focus, right, about why it is that Parliament has not reopened. So to talk about this, we're crossing over now to political scientist Professor Wong Chin Huat. Prof, thank you so much for joining us. Now, you wrote a commentary piece on Malaysia Kini stating that you think the reason for Parliament's suspension is political. Could you start by illustrating the possible outcomes if Parliament reconvenes?
The questions that we have to face with reconvening of the parliament is whether will a vote of no confidence be passed against the government. Given the government performance now, any mistakes would provide a very legitimate ground for that to happen. And if the government collapses in normal conditions, you have two options. One is to have a fresh elections, to elect a new parliament and a new government. Second is to have a new government from the same parliament. Since the pandemic makes close the door for a new election, the choice would be to have a new government. However, since PH and UMNO, the two blocs that really want the Muhyiddin governments to be ousted, cannot agree on an alternative. So we might end up in a political stalemate, where you have the government ousted but no new government. And why this is important? Because the palace holds the key of whether the parliament will be reconvened might be held back by the fear that the government will collapse without a viable alternative.
So we've been hearing arguments in favour of establishing a unity government so as to prevent political turmoil when parliament reopens. What are your thoughts on this?
Unfortunately, I think it is a wishful thinking. When you want to form a unity government, meaning that you have to bring in new parties, and since the public has no stomach for an even bloated administration than now, some of the existing parties' minister would have to give up their posts for the new parties. And so that would trigger a round of political infighting before any unity can be achieved. In other words, instead, ironically, while the purpose is to pursue political unity, you probably end up having more political disunity. Currently, we have three Malay-based nationalist parties, Bersatu, UMNO and PAS, who are supposed to provide, to deliver Malay unity. But they can't even deliver this. Can you expect more parties coming in, parties that are going to compete against each other in the next elections, deliver national unity? I think if you take two Panadols and it cannot stop your diarrhea, it would be silly to think that have six Panadols would stop your diarrhea, because you're going after the wrong medicine. What we need to solve here, if our concern is to stop all this political infighting so that we can focus on the pandemic and the economy, you need to look at the incentive offered to the politicians. And unity, a reshuffle, unfortunately, might be the last things that can do the job.
So is it right then to be taking measures to prevent this motion of no confidence? And what are the arguments for and against this?
A vote of no confidence in a parliamentary democracy is like the right to divorce in a marriage. Not having the right to divorce would turn marriage a tyranny. The same thing here. If you do not allow the parliament to pass a motions of no confidence when necessary, so then parliamentary democracy is undermined. However, it's a different story that if the parliament choose not to exercise it, so how do you avoid that? Then parliamentarians must be convinced that they want to keep the government in power. So you can actually still table it, but it will never get passed, because the parliamentarian voluntarily reject that.
So what are the other options available if we want to ensure that parliament functions optimally to handle this ongoing pandemic challenges?
The government can reach out to the oppositions and with a confidence and supply agreement, or CSA. A CSA means a deal between the government and the opposition, so that when you have a vote of no confidence against the government being tabled, the opposition would at least abstain not to support it so the government can survive. And also, when the government tabled the budget, the opposition would not vote against it. Now, a CSA is a common tool used in countries like Denmark or New Zealand post-1996. When governments are mostly minorities or with a weak majority. For example, Jacinda Ardern's first term government from 2017 to 2020 was a minority coalition government. But that government has no problem of surviving because it reached out to the Green parties with on an CSA. So the government can survive. And you can see there's no questions of political instability in New Zealand. So what we need here today in Malaysia is for the government to be bold and not fearful of losing face. Reach out to the opposition because you simply do not have a functioning majority. Reach out to the opposition, strike a deal, get their support for you to survive. In exchange, you give the opposition their right to participate in policy making so that whatever difficult decision you undertake in countering the pandemics and economic slowdown, the opposition have their say and they would back your difficult decisions. In other words, this is CSA is arrangements of power sharing via the parliament. And this is much more effective than to have a unity government, which is power sharing via the cabinet, because the current minister do not lose their posts, their power, their salary, and so on. So they don't have to worry and start another round of fighting. They can basically, a CSA would means that the minister get to keep their jobs and salary. And that's probably what most of them care the most about. But their power would be very, very critically scrutinized by the parliament through select committees. And therefore, decision-making quality will be better and tough decisions can be made because those decisions will be made after extensive consultation involving the opposition.
Ultimately then, what compromises might have to take place for these measures to be successful?
For the CSA to be successful, we basically need an empowered parliament. So it's not just about reopening the parliament, but we need to make sure that every MP who is not a minister or deputy minister, sit on at least one select committee, and every ministry would be subject to the scrutiny of a select committee. That would actually revolutionarily transform our parliament. Currently, our parliament is really a part-time institution because it meets only around 2 months in a whole year. And most of the time, throughout the years, only MPs who are minister and deputy minister get to do the job. The rest of the time, MPs' main functions are the bosses of constituency service centres. But if we have an empowered parliament, all MPs would end up being very busy. It would become a full-time institution. They would have to do a lot of work. And our policy would be scrutinized. MP would have no time making themselves crowns in the parliament. And they would have no time to take up another salary in GLC and so on. We would see very, very different politics than what we are seeing today. And how to make that happen? We need the key institution here, the palace, the rulers conference to see this. But most importantly, for ordinary Malaysians to see this, you see, when the current emergency was proclaimed in January, many Malaysians took it very lightly. What's wrong if the parliament is not open? You know, we have been living our life without the parliament. That's fine. The parliament is just a joke. But today, you find many ordinary Malaysians are calling out for parliament to be reconvened and not just MPs, not just civil society groups. And that's changed the game. if we come to a point that when ordinary Malaysians tell the politicians and say, we want a confidence and supply agreement between you all, not closing down the parliament, not buying over MPs with offers of GLCs or ministerial posts. When enough ordinary Malaysians know about what CSA is and demand a CSA, the CSA would happen. So you matters. You ultimately decide how this country, where this country is going.
Prof, thank you so much for speaking with us. That was political scientist Professor Wong Chin Huat talking about the ramifications, the political ramifications specifically of having a reconvening of parliament, even in a hybrid form. Now, that's what we've been focusing on, right? So after this, we're going to be looking at other countries that have done the same and specifically focusing on the UK parliament. Keep it here on Inside Story, BFM 89.9.
Break from monotony, BFM 89.9.
It is 6:50. You're listening to Inside Story with Lynn and Sharmila. We've been focusing on a hybrid parliament, which is something we might soon have or we might see convene here in the country. And now we want to look at examples abroad. And for that, we are crossing over to Patrick Diamond, Associate Professor of Public Policy at the Queen Mary University of London. Patrick, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much. Good to be with you.
So for several months last year, the UK Parliament functioned on a hybrid basis, with most of the MPs contributing to debates remotely. How well did it work at the time?
Yeah, the UK hybrid parliament system meant that in the House of Commons, at any given time, there were around 50 MPs who were physically present in the chamber. And then there were around 120 MPs who could join proceedings virtually through Zoom. And obviously, their questions or comments were televised on television screens in the chamber, which ministers could reply to. I think the general view in the UK is that the system has worked quite well. It has kept democracy functioning. There have, of course, been teething problems and difficulties with technology, but it has allowed MPs, particularly those who represent areas that are a long way from London, to continue to represent their constituents. So I think overall, the view is that this has been a rather successful democratic experiment.
The UK actually managed to get this going pretty fast. They actually started in April last year. How did they manage this all so quickly?
Oh, that's a very good question, because not everything that we do in the UK is necessarily world leading when it comes to technology. But I think in this area, you're quite correct that the speed of transition towards a virtual parliamentary system was very rapid. I think there are a couple of reasons for that. One is that there has been some experimentation, even pre-COVID, with using technology as a way of increasing accessibility to democracy. So using, for example, online forums whereby citizens can directly access government decision makers, speak directly to ministers, get involved in discussions about policy and so on. So there's been already some, even pre-COVID, experiment with that, which was drawn upon. I think that the other reason, though, is that, you know, the British system, Parliament plays a very central role in our democracy, and it's very important in holding the executive to account. So I think that even at the start of the pandemic, with everything else that was going on, there was a feeling that it was a real priority to make sure that Parliament could continue to function and scrutinise and hold the government to account. So a lot of effort and energy and resources were devoted to this. But as you say, yeah, it has been a really successful experiment.
And were there any teething issues or challenges that stood out?
Yeah, I think that there were particular aspects of parliamentary procedure or particular elements of weekly parliamentary debate where perhaps the virtual system did not work quite as successfully. So Prime Minister's Questions, which is the kind of centrepiece of each week in Parliament, where MPs get to scrutinise the Prime Minister directly, I think there was a feeling that perhaps the virtual system was not as effective at making this process worthwhile. Obviously, having fewer MPs in the chamber means that the whole debate feels perhaps a bit more stayed, a bit more non-confrontational. That takes away from the sort of drama of the event. And also, I think the Prime Minister at times found it difficult because MPs would try to ask questions, but then, of course, the Zoom link would fail or something would happen with the technology. So perhaps that aspect has been less successful. But in terms of the sort of day-to-day parliamentary business, holding votes, making sure that questioning of other ministers can take place, it's worked fine, I think, so far.
So when did the hybrid system come to an end and what led to that happening?
Well, the hybrid system hasn't fully come to an end, so there is still some elements of hybridity. It's still possible, for example, for MPs to attend debates and questions with ministers using the virtual system. And there's also discussion still underway about whether the legislative process should continue to have an element of hybridity. Of course, in the UK, the situation with COVID has improved, but we're not back to normal. And one of the difficulties that we face with our parliamentary chamber is that it's physically organised. You may be familiar with it, but it's organised in such a way that MPs are very tightly packed together. And so I think it will be some time before you could go back to holding traditional sittings with all of the MPs sitting in the chamber with no social distancing. And so an element of hybridity is likely to continue. Of course, there is a discussion underway about whether it should become permanent, because it does confer advantages. For example, MPs who have to travel long geographical distances would be able to spend more time with their constituents if they were able to attend Parliament through these kinds of virtual structures. So, you know, I think that there's a longer term debate underway, which is about what happens once the coronavirus crisis has really been resolved. Do we, in fact, want to retain some of these systems, not just because of COVID, but because we think they actually make for a better functioning parliamentary democracy?
And do you think that's likely? Do you see that happening?
Well, I mean, there are opponents of it because, of course, there are traditionalists who believe that, you know, these virtual systems somehow undermine the quality of British democracy. You know, Westminster democracy functions by having MPs physically present together. I spoke a minute ago about the drama of Prime Minister's questions where MPs shout at one another and exchange often harsh words, but it does give a sense of debate and deliberation. And there are some traditionalists who worry that once you move to a virtual system or a hybrid system, that you reduce this this quality of democracy. But then there are others who argue, look, you know, the benefits could be very considerable. I've already spoken about the ways in which it allows MPs to engage more from a distance. It may also, though, in the future be possible to link citizens more directly into the procedures and policy debates that are underway in Parliament. So I think for the for those who favour these kinds of technological innovations, they're going to push for making at least some of these changes permanent.
So ultimately, what did Parliament achieve during these hybrid proceedings?
Well, of course, much of the focus of the last year since the new hybrid structure was put in place in April 2020 has been on COVID-related matters, discussing with government ministers, you know, progress on controlling the infection, the various issues that have been discussed about the state of the health service, putting in place an effective test and trace system, dealing, of course, with management of borders. And I think there is a feeling that we have been able to continue to hold the government to account during this period. Government ministers have been compelled to appear in the House of Commons to answer direct questions, even if some of those questions come virtually through MPs dining in, using these technologies. So I do feel that in a period when there may have been a concern that the government would not have been as rigorously held to account as it has been previously, this technology and the hybrid system has enabled, at a critical time for British democracy, the executive, the government of the day, to be held to account robustly by MPs.
Patrick, thank you so much for speaking with us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
That was Patrick Diamond, Associate Professor of Public Policy at Queen Mary University of London, explaining how it is that the UK Parliament functioned on a hybrid basis now that we are thinking of doing the same, or at least studying a way in which we could do the same. That at least is the promise. Let us know if you have thoughts or questions. You can send them our way. Call 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. This has been Inside Story, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.